Welcome to this Forthright Radio for September 4th, 2019. I'm Joy LaClaire. Quote, "What happens to democracy when the President of the United States labels critical media outlets as enemies of the people and derides the search for truth by endlessly tweeting lies and misrepresentation? What happens to democracy when individuals and groups are demonized on the basis of their religion? How does a culture whose mission is to keep democracy alive give way to political, economic, and pedagogical arrangements that normalize a hatred of democracy? How does neoliberalism use corporate-controlled cultural apparatuses to destroy the communal cohesion necessary to nurture support for the common good, shared democratic values, and a compassion for others? How does neoliberalism's regressive embrace of individual responsibility work to reduce all social problems to personal failings and, in doing so, empty politics of any substance while undermining a grammar of ethics and moral bearings needed to distinguish good from evil?" End quote. Today, we welcome back Professor Henri Giroux to Forthright Radio, and these are among the questions he addresses in his latest book, from which I just quoted, The Terror of the Unforeseen, published by LARB Provocations from the Los Angeles Review of Books, just the latest of over 65 books he has written. Henri Giroux is the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy at McMaster University in Hamilton, Canada. The Toronto Star has named him one of the 12 Canadians changing the way we think. He's also been named in Routledge's Key Guides as one of the top 50 educational thinkers of the modern period. He's on the editorial and advisory boards of numerous national and international scholarly journals. He's on the board of directors for Truthout. This is a highly edited introduction. I could go on much longer listing his achievements and honors, but I'll stop there. And I'll simply welcome you back to Forthright Radio, Professor Henri Giroux.
Yes, hi. It's wonderful to be back.
Oh, thank you so much, Henri. In my introduction, I quoted from your latest book, The Terror of the Unforeseen, in which you focus on the current form of capitalism that is global and which you call neoliberalism. Now, this can be a very confusing term because of the combination of neo, meaning new, and liberalism, which many assume means a willingness to respect or accept behavior or opinions different from one's own, openness to new ideas, or a political philosophy based on the belief in progress and the essential goodness of the human race, and standing for the protection of political and civil liberties, and considering government as a crucial instrument for amelioration of social inequities. But that is definitely not what neoliberalism means. Could you please explain what it does mean and how it has become so dominant, not just in the United States, but around the world?
I think that the best way to describe neoliberalism is that to in many ways mimic something that David Harvey has said. He said it's basically a belief that markets are not only self-sufficient unto themselves and don't need regulation, but that the best guarantors of human welfare. In other words, it's marked by the rational belief, in my mind, of the ability of markets to solve all problems. Not just it wants to control not only the economy, but the whole of social life, so that markets become the template for structuring all kinds of social relationships. And I think that under neoliberalism, what you find is really the attempt on the part of a political and economic system to consolidate class power in the hands of a financial elite. And it seems to me that under neoliberalism, all matters are reduced to an act of commerce or measured by commercial relations. Neoliberalism sort of construes that profit-making is the essence of democracy and consuming is the only form of citizenship. But it actually does more. It operates off the assumption that all problems are basically personal problems, that the government should only exist through basically get out of the way of corporations, that it believes in an unchecked kind of individualism, harsh competition, replaces the notion of the public good in all forms of solidarity with the ethos of consumerism, economics. It drives politics as money and markets set policies. Its deregulation often results in forms of lawlessness and armed violence, in which all of a sudden regulations that are put into place to protect health, occupational safety, the planet itself are eliminated, as we see happening under Trump. And it seems to me that its long-term goals and investments, it believes in short-term investments. It doesn't believe in long-term investments. It believes that we need to eliminate, privatize, deregulate, commodify anything that basically speaks to the public good. So it represents a major attack on the welfare state and on the social contract. And that's where it really differs from liberalism. It shares with liberalism its faith in individualism, although it carries it to extreme. But whereas liberalism sort of believed in the social contract, neoliberalism wants to eliminate the social contract. And it believes that any form of public service, any form of social funding, any attempt to get the government involved in addressing social problems or in some way coming to grips with some of the issues that plague the nation as a social whole has to be eliminated.
You write that neoliberalism is the new fascism. Now, fascism is a word that can be, and these days often is, misused. In fact, frequently in the recent past, authoritarians often call pushback to their statements or incidents promoting racism, misogyny, homophobia, or xenophobia as being fascist repression of their freedom of expression. So what do you mean by fascism, and how can one distinguish it from misuse or trivialization?
I think there are two issues to consider here before that question can be answered. And I think that people who often argue that using fascism is really a way to disable an argument, but people choose to recognize that fascism comes in many forms, so that you can talk about a fascist politics that's marked by certain kinds of elements that actually run across almost all fascists, whether we're talking about a politics of racial purity, ultra-nationalism, the notion of a country being in decline, the elevation of instinct over emotion, and emotion rather over reason, an embrace of anti-intellectualism, a contempt for dissent in the rule of law, contempt for weakness, a kind of hyper-masculinity, but most importantly, a kind of friend-enemy distinction that basically speaks to questions of social cleansing and racial purity. And it seems to me that people like Hannah Arendt, Sheldon Wolin, a whole range of historians and political theorists have argued that what we often see is that fascism never really dies. It just tends to reinvent itself and emerge in different forms. So I think that what we need to ask ourselves, in what way do we see today in the United States and in countries such as Hungary, Poland, particularly now in Brazil, which is frightening, those elements of fascism that really echo and resonate very strongly with the past and serve as a warning signal to basically not only to the death of democracy, but to the rise of a fascist politics in which the surface elements of fascism now move from the margins of power to the center of power.
You quote the writer Fintan O'Toole. You say Fintan O'Toole may be right in arguing that such actions constitute a trial run for fascism. And this is the quote: "Fascism doesn't arise suddenly in an existing democracy. It's not easy to get people to give up their ideas of freedom and civility. You have to do trial runs that, if they are done well, serve two purposes. They get people used to something they may initially recoil from, and they allow you to refine and calibrate. This is what's happening now, and we would be fools not to see it." End quote. I thought that was a very powerful quote that you put in your book, The Terror of the Unforeseen, Henri Giroux. Could you please expand on what Fintan O'Toole says, and maybe give us some examples that our listeners can relate to?
Well, I think that fascism begins with language. It begins with the language of brutality. And if it's endlessly stated enough, that language tends to become normalized. And I think that around the question of language, we have certainly seen that with Trump. From the moment he began his campaign claiming that undocumented immigrants are rapists, criminals, drug pushers, and so on, increasingly we have seen that he's gone further and further in implementing this language of racial purity and white supremacy, ethnic cleansing, and the language of disposability in a series of policies. And they just get worse as time goes on. I mean, first of all, we're putting new restrictions, militarizing the border, putting new restrictions on whether or not immigrants can even enter the United States. All of a sudden, we're separating children from their parents and basically mimicking echoes of the past, which are quite frightening in terms of what that suggests. All of a sudden, we find ourselves with the death penalty being imposed. We see a language emerging at first in which Trump claims the press is the enemy of the American people. And then we see increasing threats to implement policies that would shut down the press if possible. So it seems to me that as this language of racism and nativism, this discourse about the wall, the increasing militarization of American society, the increasingly use of labels to claim that people of the press are not only people who implement fake news, but he is now increasingly arguing that they're treasonous, that the press is treasonous. I mean, he went so far halfway at one point in one of his rallies to claim after his first State of the Union address, he said, well, you know, the Democrats didn't get up and applaud at the end of my speech. I mean, is he for real? And then he goes on to say, people are yelling treason, treason. And he says, yeah, that's right. That sounds like treason. Well, you know, when somebody commits an act of treason, you know what that means. That means they violate the law to the extent that they can be put in jail and they can be tried for treason and in some cases executed for that crime. So it seems to me the language has increasingly gotten worse. The policies have become more cruel. The attempt to sort of speak almost directly to his white nationalist base has become more shrill. I mean, this recent attack on the four congresswomen of color claiming they should go back to their country, to the countries that they came from, his increasing attack on black people in general, calling them stupid and uneducated, everything from sports commentators to athletes to CNN hosts. I mean, all of this over time sort of normalizes something that I want to say speaks to the unspeakable. The rule of lawlessness, the suspension of power, the refusal to deal with Congress, the corruption that we see, these endless acts of corruption Trump has engaged in, now claiming that the G7, when it meets next year, can somehow take advantage of one of his golf courses so he can make millions of dollars as if the emolument clause doesn't exist. So we see an incredibly extended intensification of lawlessness on the part of Trump in almost every area, whether we're talking about policy, whether we're talking about language, whether we're talking about ideology. And I think where O'Toole is right is that he's trying to see how far he can push the envelope. I mean, one of the recent comments by one of his appointees claiming that the quote on the Statue of Liberty really is not right, that the only people who really should come here should come from Norway, you know, and be wealthy. I mean, you have to wonder where this ends.
I can't help noting that as far as the emoluments clause goes, just within the last 24, 48 hours, Vice President Pence stayed at Trump's golf course in the west coast of Ireland in preparing for his meeting with the Prime Minister of Ireland on the east coast of Ireland, a three-hour drive, 180 miles away. And reports say that President Trump didn't order Vice President Pence to stay there. He invited Pence to stay there or suggested he stay there. However, it's also noted that the bill is going to the taxpayers of the United States into the coffers of Mr. Trump. So that's just one tiny example. And not to mention, you talk, Henry Giroux, in your book, and you emphasize the erasure of historic memory. The reason Vice President Pence was on that side of the Atlantic was because President Trump canceled his trip to Poland commemorating the anniversary of the beginning of World War II, the invasion of Poland by Germany, ostensibly because he needed to monitor Hurricane Dorian. However, he spent the weekend, reportedly, at his golf course. So do you have anything to add to that, or should we just move on?
You're always very insightful about these kinds of details, which has to be applauded, because I think there's a message in the details, and the message is that Trump is utterly corrupt, but more than that, he's unabashedly corrupt, which means that he wears it like a badge. And I think this is part of something that we haven't seen in a long time, and that is you have an American president who basically surrounds himself and embraces dictators, such as Bolsonaro, who is a despicable authoritarian, who is now destroying the rainforest, and refers to people in the streets who are poor and who are protesting as cockroaches. He basically has completely removed himself from any sense of ethical responsibility. He lies. He's a pathological liar. He embraces a notion of militarism that I think is modeled after Kim Jong-un. And so I think that Trump now lives in a kind of bubble in which the only people who matter to him, and he once said, I believe in unity. I believe in the unity of my people, and nobody else matters. And I think that we're now seeing this in a way that permeates almost every aspect of his daily life and his rule. And the question is, at what point do the American people wake up and say, we have a full-fledged demagogue in office here? He's dangerous. He's ruining the planet. He's ruining people's lives. He's making the ultra-rich richer. And basically, he surrounds himself with dictators who also are basically enabled by him and increasingly legitimated, their actions legitimated by what he says. And at what point do we recognize that democracy is not only under siege, but it's in its death throes?
Now, I don't want our listeners to think that we are only focusing on the 45th president of the United States, Donald Trump. And in your book, Henry Giroux, The Terror of the Unforeseen, you do mention that he didn't just arise like Venus on the half shell out of the ocean. From at least the 1970s on, both parties, both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, set up the stage for the ascension of President Trump into the White House. And you even talk about what you describe as irony, and I think that that's a mild term. And I'm going to quote from your book again. Let's see. Liberal and conservative politicians such as Madeleine Albright, Hillary Clinton, and even James Clapper, the former director of National Intelligence, are now claiming that they have joined the resistance against Trump's fascist politics. Even Michael Hayden, the former NSA chief and CIA director under George W. Bush, has joined the ranks of Albright and Clinton in condemning Trump as a proto-fascist. Writing in the New York Times, Hayden ironically chastised Trump as a serial liar, and in doing so, quoted the renowned historian Timothy Snyder, who stated in reference to the Trump regime that, quote, post-truth is pre-fascism, end quote. The irony here is hard to miss. Not only did Hayden head Bush's illegal National Security Agency warrantless wiretapping program while the head of the NSA, he also lied repeatedly about his role in Bush's sanctioning and implementation of state torture in Afghanistan and Iraq. So please remind us of the actual history that led up to Trump's being able to do what he does today.
I mean, the issue here is that what neoliberal fascism does is it basically supports a very powerful form of historical amnesia. And I think in many ways we have progressive and left and liberal critics engaging in that very form of historical amnesia by focusing almost exclusively on Trump. Trump is a symptom. That's what he is. He's a symptom of something that has a much greater historical reach than simply the election of Trump in 2016. I mean, these forces have been going on for a long time. I mean, the forces of financial capital, the forces of militarism, the racism, the massive inequality that has taken place in the country since the 1970s, the hatred of government, the marriage to Goldman Sachs, politicians on both parties turning their backs on the plight of workers and people who were basically destroyed by the financial crisis of 2008. I mean, in my estimation, what you have here is you have a Republican Party that basically has a long record of building up the language of racial purity and white supremacy and militarism and nationalism. And that, of course, represents one side of Trump. The other side of this is you have the Clintons, you have Obama. I mean, these are people who basically embraced Goldman Sachs. I mean, these are people who embraced a system marked by enormous inequality. And while they may have done some progressive programs, especially Obama rather than Clinton, in a sense, they set the stage for Trump, because Trump railed and won support as a faux populist in relation to some of the policies that Obama and Clinton particularly had implemented. So I think that what we really need to recognize here is you have a far-right extremist party in the Republican Party, a party of now white nationalists and basically ultra-nationalists, and in the Democratic Party, you have a party that still believes in centrism. I mean, they still believe that education should be free. They still believe that health care should be universal. They still believe that we should do everything we can to eliminate the power of corporations. They still believe that inequality, basically, as long as it's checked, the dynamics that produce it are okay. They still believe that in some fundamental way, America, the United States is marked by its exceptionalism, which I would think, without irony, is one of constantly invading and ruining countries since almost its inception. So it seems to me that this kind of logic that once Trump is defeated, everything will be okay, is basically a refusal to recognize that the United States is now marked by a form of capitalism, extreme capitalism, that really is the antithesis of democracy, and that we need to mobilize a movement that recognizes that capitalism and democracy are not the same. And we have to really rethink a politics that takes seriously questions of equity, you know, questions of social justice, questions of equality, in ways that rewrite the very script of politics so that we can start talking about democratic socialism in a way that basically would reinvent democracy in some of its more progressive, radical forms.
Henry Giroux, you write about the various ways violence can manifest. And you say language is one of them. But before we go to that, talk about slow violence.
The concept of slow violence is not my term. It comes from a guy named Rob Nixon. It's a wonderful concept because outside of the violence of the spectacle, mass shootings, televised almost now daily on American television, there was a kind of slow violence. And that's a violence that you don't quite see in its destruction. It sort of lies beneath the surface. For instance, the privatization of prisons, a kind of violence that goes on there that is not really apparent until all of a sudden you have prison riots, you have people getting killed, you have people getting sick, or the defunding of public schools, which creates a form of civic illiteracy that basically changes the political landscape and makes it vulnerable to demagogues, or tax measures that basically increase massive forms of inequality that over time destroy public goods, destroy the healthcare system. Or you have attacks on the welfare system that use the latest technologies to monitor and track people and to set up all kinds of technological obstacles that make it very, very difficult for them to be able to access the funds that they needed to simply stay alive. This is the kind of violence that produces a kind of massive anger and increasingly an outrage, because it tends for people to believe that it's mobilized by elites rather than by actual systems, political, economic, and social systems that need to be addressed. So the question of slow violence, or I'll give you another example, the increasing criminalization of social problems. Homelessness is now a crime. Students in schools are now arrested for violating dress codes. People walking on the wrong side of the street are endlessly fined in poor cities so that basically they can contribute to the retirement funds of the police. this is the kind of violence that wears people down to the point where time becomes an utter deprivation, because people are constantly under harassment. People are constantly find themselves in a fight for survival. It's a very degrading form of violence, and it does everything it can to destroy. And it's the most powerful momentum, it seems to me, is to completely eliminate a vibrant civic culture, along with an increasing systemic erosion of any sense of citizenship. It's a really awful form of violence that we don't give enough detail to, enough analysis of.
Well, that can certainly not be said of you, Henri Giroux. In your book, The Terror of the Unforeseen, you go into great detail and are very explicit of that as an issue. You also address in The Terror of the Unforeseen the problem of gun violence in the United States, and you analyze it in terms of the crisis of both gun violence in the United States and the educational system in the United States. Recently, we've been subjected to mass shootings after mass shootings, but I want to share with you somewhat breaking news. Yesterday, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors declared the National Rifle Association a domestic terrorist organization. And as far as I know, that is, if not the first, it's one of the first organized political bodies to do so. Now, you go into this in the second part of your book. You talk about more hopeful elements, using both the organizing of teachers and the organizing of students. Let's direct our discussion that way. First, please begin with the students, because we are talking about mass shootings and that sort of thing.
Well, I think there are a couple of things to say, and that is that, first of all, you have these young people who basically now find themselves in schools modeled after prisons, because the question of fear and terror has not only, as an organizing principle of the United States, it now begins to seep into some of its most cherished institutions, including schools. And I think that many students are just fed up with that. I think many students don't want to see their schools. They want to see them as protective spaces, not spaces that are marked by the increased use of police, or are marked by a discourse that seems to suggest that they have nothing to do with learning and everything to do with security. That just reinforces the authoritarian dimensions of a larger society and political system. Secondly, they're exhibiting enormous courage because they're saying, we've had enough. As this violence actually seeps into the school and is legitimated by both the larger society and the school, that being that schools are increasingly defined on the side of violence, against it, or so to speak, but in the same narrative, their horizons are much broader. Thirdly, they're taking it to the streets. I mean, I think that what they're recognizing is that the problem of gun violence in part is about the crisis of ideas, that we've got to rethink what it means to live in a society where there are more guns than there are people inhabiting that society, and what are the forces that are benefiting from it, and who are the politicians that basically have blood on their hands because they refuse to do anything about it because they're supported by the lobbyists that are part of the gun industry. More than that, they're linking up with, it seems to me, many of them are linking up with groups all over the country to talk about violence in broader terms, to talk about violence as a systemic organizing principle of American society, and gun violence being one of the attributes of that. So it seems to me they've moved from very specific discourse on gun rights, developing policies that speak of gun reform, to a much wider understanding of violence in general. I mean, I think that this board that labels the NRA as a form of domestic terrorism, that's a fabulous move, because it seems to me that that's how we need to talk about gun violence. We need to talk about it as a form of state and domestic violence, and that we need to understand who are the interests that benefit from it, why, how is it being legitimated in a whole range of venues, from entertainment to sports to news media and its spectacles, to politicians who basically have blood on their hands because they support the arms industry and the gun industry through the lobbyists that basically give them thousands and thousands of dollars and threaten that they won't be reelected if they don't follow their policies. I mean, these people are not just cowards. I mean, these people are Vichy Republicans, and they're people who basically have sold their souls to a corporate form of violence. that is just overwhelming at this point. I mean, the number of mass shootings that we've seen in the last 8 months is mind-staggering. And yet, these politicians absolutely refuse to even talk about creating laws that regulate who can has access to guns. And that's a minor reform. That's not even a major reform.
And further, federal agencies that might research the subject have been threatened through legislation of having their funding cut off if they were to do so. So there's a lot of work to be done there. I also feel that the students, as you say, they're very courageous, but they're also extremely clear-sighted, and they just call BS, that's their term, BS, on the whole apologists for the Second Amendment, having actually experienced the horror, gun violence in their schools. Now, let's talk about the teachers and the rising up of the teachers in some of the most conservative states in the United States.
One of the things that I'm quite excited about is that we're seeing teachers all over the country sort of all of a sudden step back and say, we've had enough. These neoliberal policies that want to privatize, commodify, and regulate schools by defunding them and turning them over to private interest, or just basically shutting them down in general and putting in place charter schools that basically benefit nothing more than a neoliberal ideology. All of a sudden, they're saying, hey, look, we're not going to put up with this anymore. Teaching matters. We need to have some control over the conditions of our own labor. But more than that, schools are not just about our own interest. They're not just about getting larger salaries or having more resources. They're also about providing the resources that students need to be able to survive in these schools and to flourish. We need more social services. We need more counselors. I mean, this is a very broad-based movement that we see. And I think that the fact that they've done this is the beginning of a potentially powerful attempt for these movements to come together with or without unions. The unions want to join in, fine. If they don't, they want to be cravenly and cowardly and just sort of speak to their own interests, then I think they should be bypassed. But where they want to join in, that's very important, and create a national movement. We need a national movement of educators in defense of schools as a public good. That's what we need. And we need an international movement that basically works in tandem with that. Because it seems to me what educators and teachers, these brave teachers, have recognized is not just simply that they're underpaid, underserved, and basically viewed as disposable in this neoliberal economy, which confuses training with education. I think that what they've recognized is that they may be the most important public servants that we have, who are still capable of educating generations to be able to be critical, to be critically engaged, and to be able to work on behalf of social problems in the defense of a real democracy.
Yes, and I think one can tell a lot about a society in terms of what it values by what it pays for. And over the last 40 years or so, education has been less and less funded, in some cases defunded. At the university level, it's been corporatized. An example of this can be found in the so-called private universities and what the Trump administration, Department of Education, Betsy DeVos, how little cooperation she has given to students who paid for education and were promised certain things and it didn't happen. It was basically fraud, and how difficult it is to get redress for that. And also, are you familiar with the ongoing fiasco of student debt and those who signed up to have their debt forgiven if they did public service kind of things, and now they're getting fine printed out of that? Are you familiar with that, Henry?
I'm somewhat familiar, but I think the larger issue here is that what we have in this country right now, and it's been going on for a long time, is a war on youth. And I think the war on youth takes many forms, whether it's the bombardment of an outrageous commercial culture that tries to turn kids into nothing more than consumers, or commodifies them as potential consumers, as potential commodities, or you get the hard war. And the other part of the soft war is, of course, the mobilization of what I call disimagination machines. I mean, endless attempts on the part of politicians and some right-wing educators, such as DeVos, who's really an embarrassment. I mean, she's ruthless and she's an embarrassment. She's a member of the financial elite who hates public education, as we all know, and will do everything she can to dismantle it. But I think the other side of this is that you have the school-to-prison pipeline, which is even worse than it's ever been. Schools are as segregated today, it seems to me, as they were 50 years ago. And you have a war on higher education that is now relatively complete. I mean, 70% of all faculty in higher education, as you know, are now adjuncts or have temporary contracts. And you know what that means? That doesn't just mean that they live in fear of their jobs. That's the death of social criticism on the part. That's a death of academic freedom because they're afraid to speak out. I mean, you know, you have to note that you have teachers in high schools, in the public schools, demonstrating all over the country for a whole range of social rights. Where are the intellectuals and the academics? I mean, this is like incredibly silent around what's happening to higher education. And yet, it seems to me that they've lost the war. They can't even defend the conditions of their own labor anymore because they have almost nothing to say about the university as a crucial democratic public sphere, while at the same time being reduced to a form of indentured servitude that mimics the same indentured servitude that's being imposed on students through this massive debt that now exceeds consumer debt. And what that means is that students are basically going to move away from public service, be absolutely consumed by trying to pay off this debt, in many cases for the rest of their lives, and that's a form of depoliticization. That's what we have to understand here. What we're seeing is the depoliticization of institutions that should be engaged in the creation of generations that are insightful, that have access to the great traditions of knowledge, Western and otherwise, that are capable of self and reflective criticism, that have a deep understanding of their own lives, their relationship to others and the globe. All of that is being eliminated through a neoliberal fascist discourse that is intent, absolutely intent, on mobilizing people into forms of right-wing populism and the policies that it produces.
I would like to discuss something that isn't specific in your book, but comes up, and that is the concept of the put down of something being politically correct. And there have been some very interesting articles written about that recently, and how it immediately shuts down any kind of discussion of anything that smacks of empathy or humanitarianism or anything like that, particularly in the context of the university. Have you experienced that, or do you have any comments about that?
I think that kind of language is really a verbal gimmick to really prevent people from being responsible for what they say and do. I mean, all of a sudden now it's fashionable to be a racist. It's fashionable to be a nativist. It's fashionable to hate people who, according to, if they're marginalized by race, class, or gender, or otherwise. I think that we have to understand that within a larger project of lying and misrepresentation and alternative facts, for which the truth now becomes dangerous. And I don't view it as anything else. I mean, I think that within the university, where it's being used, particularly by the right wing, the claim that they're the true avatars of freedom of speech is just nonsense. I mean, I think that what this language about political correctness means is that we want to have the right to basically produce hate speech. We want to have the right to be racist. We want to have the right to use the language of humiliation, and that we shouldn't be held accountable for that. And if we're held accountable for that, well, that's a form of being political correctness. It's just such an empty argument. It's nothing more than a gimmick to allow people to remove themselves from any sense of social and political and moral responsibility.
Well, it's an expression that certainly on the campaign trail and in some of his speeches, President Trump has dismissed criticisms as being politically correct, and that he prides himself in not being politically correct, and that he reverts to quote unquote common sense. And to me, that resonates with what you have written in your book, The Terror of the Unforeseen, Henri Giroux, that when the market is the fundamental of everything, then what works for the market seems as common sense, regardless of the impacts on the environment, regardless how many children die, how many thousands more people will die of asthma and related illnesses because of deregulation of environmental regulations, that sort of thing. But it seems to me that it is all too effective, a tactic. How does one effectively respond, do you think?
First of all, let me just say something about the initial commentary. And that is, you know, look, under neoliberalism, one of its most dreadful, dreadful assumptions is that economic activity can be removed from social cost, meaning that whatever economic activity is engaged in, you never have to worry about how it affects people. If it pollutes the air, who cares? If there's lead in the water and we save money, then there's lead in the water. Who cares about the children who are affected by that? And I think the question that we have to raise is, how has this become normalized? I mean, in what way, what processes, what practices, what institutions have been at work for so undermining the possibility for critical analysis, the possibility for saying, hey, look, that's not about democracy, or undermining the civic institutions that give democracy, make the ethos of democracy important. As long as the language of democracy, the language of civic literacy, the language of civic culture, the language of civic responsibility is downplayed and eliminated and subordinated to the logic of the market, people have no language for basically criticizing this. They have no way of recognizing that when Reagan said government is the enemy of people, that that's a particular political position that benefits a very specific group of people. Or when Margaret Thatcher says there's no such thing as society, what she's saying is that we will not put money into infrastructure, we will not put money into social provisions, we will not put money into places that will help people live a better life, that we're really basically going to support policies that support the ultra-rich, the corporations, and those people who organize their lives around greed. And so it seems to me the precondition for dealing with all of this is making education central to politics. You know, Marx said the point is not to interpret the world, the point is to change it. Well, he was wrong. Actually, you can't change the world unless you understand it. And so it seems to me until we make education central to politics and we learn how to talk to people in ways that they can recognize themselves in our language, until we can talk about the specificity of the problems that they are operating under, we're in big trouble. We're in trouble. Ideas matter. Education matters. And until we take the question of civic literacy and civic culture seriously, we're in big trouble. Because I'll tell you why. The crisis of neoliberal fascism is not matched by a crisis of ideas. Neoliberalism doesn't even attempt any longer to offer people the promise of social mobility. It doesn't attempt any longer to say, well, you'll have a better life. There'll be trickle-down rewards. It doesn't do that anymore. Now it aligns itself with a fascist politics that basically demonizes other people and claims they're the real source of all our problems. It's a politics of diversion that's convenient, it's comfortable, and it works. But until we take seriously what it means to educate people to be able to understand these issues, I think we're in big trouble.
Well, as you mention in your writings, one of the problems is that of reimagination. I love the quote from Ursula Le Guin you have. She wrote, quote, "We live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. So did the divine right of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings." End of quote. Go ahead.
I love the notion that power is not just about domination. Power is also about resistance. And I think we need to recognize that resistance is always possible and that people are unfinished. And that it seems to me that under certain conditions, there's a much greater possibility for organizing people against these really awful, oppressive forces that are now being mobilized all over the world. And I think that in many ways, we see that. We see that in young people. We see that now in the demonstrations in Brazil against Bolsonaro. We see it in Hong Kong. We need mass demonstrations that can be translated into mass movements. We need to recognize that capitalism is a death march. It's a death march. Its notion of progress is utterly destructive. Its notion of individual interest is way out of proportion to any notion of the social good. And it has no faith in democracy, which it sees as a way to hold back a very limited and small group of people from amassing millions that they don't need. Millions that basically undermine any notion of democracy as we know it.
Well, you actually have written that democracy, they see it as democracy is the enemy of neoliberal capital, global capital. I like the term anarcho-capitalism because the push to, as completely as possible, deregulate capitalism, to me, is the anarchism of capitalism.
I'm sorry, Joy, say that again.
Well, I like the term anarcho-capitalism because if the neoliberal model is allowed to go to its ultimate extreme, it would completely deregulate any regulations on capitalism, and that would be an anarchism of capitalism.
I mean, that's what we're seeing in neoliberal fascism, right? I mean, what we're seeing is a complete deregulation, privatization, and commodification of society in ways unlike we've ever seen before. I mean, this guy, Trump, is basically the apostle of neoliberalism. He's not a populist at all. I mean, Trump is really basically, he's the high priest of corporate casino capitalism. And I think that he's doing everything that he can in the short time that he's in office, because since, of course, the Republicans control the Senate, to push through laws that basically are creating a moral and political crisis unlike anything we've ever seen before. And the thought of having four more years of this guy and the people who support him and the institutions that he basically is developing is utterly frightening.
Well, that brings up the question of the upcoming 2020 U.S. elections. Given the manipulation by foreign elements and other factors, do you have anything to say about the upcoming elections?
I think there are two things to say about this upcoming election. I think that the first thing is that everything must be done in every way possible to stop Trump. That's the first thing. That's the pragmatic issue. The second issue is we need to find a way to build a social movement in which elections basically have some viability in that they really do represent the possibility of people in one instance to be able to say something about the conditions under which they live and what it might mean for them to shape those conditions. We cannot exist in a two-party system. It doesn't work. These parties are basically the center and the right of capitalist interest. They do not represent the people and basically increasingly never will. Thirdly, it seems to me, we've got to think beyond elections. Elections are rigged, except that maybe the certain local levels and state levels. If elections mean something in terms of getting right-wingers out of power and being able to improve the quality of people's lives as a short-term reform, I'm for that. But in the long run, we really need an anti-capitalist radical restructuring of American society, and that's going to take the emergence of a new political movement that basically is unabashedly about human needs and about social justice and about equality and about everything that makes a democracy viable. And that's going to take a long time.
We have 30 seconds left, Henry Giroux. Do you see any aspects of that arising?
I think it's happening all over the world. I mean, I think that the contradictions are becoming very severe. I think young people have realized they refuse to be written out of the logic of democracy anymore. You know, people in Hong Kong are sacrificing their lives for the question of freedom and justice. People in Brazil are marching against a tyrant who basically would like to destroy the environment in the interest of profit, while at the same time reverting back to a period in which Brazil was ruled by dictators. I think under Trump, people are increasingly realizing that whatever he has to say has nothing to do with democracy, and that his base is basically a base that is supported by a kind of civic illiteracy and a confusion and an ignorance that needs to be challenged. And that
Henry, I'm so sorry, but we are absolutely out of time. Thank you so much for joining us again on Forthright Radio.
All right, you bet.
We've been speaking with Professor Henri Giroux. His latest book is The Terror of the Unforeseen. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson, I'm Joy LaClaire. You can go to forthright.media to hear archived editions of the show. Till next time, this is Joy LaClaire signing out for now.